So hi everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of Memcast. I'm your host, Dr. Rachel Saville, and this week we welcome Dr. Dennis Poon to the show. So Dennis is a gastroenterology registrar here in the East Midlands, and he has an interest in luminal gastroenterology. His PhD looked into chronic diarrhoea, so that's the topic we're going to be talking about today. It's a pleasure to have you join us today.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for the invitation.
So we're going to talk about, like I say, your area of expertise today. So over the course of the next 10 to 20 minutes, I'll ask you about how chronic diarrhea is defined, key points to ask in the history, and some important investigations that can help differentiate between causes of chronic diarrhea. So we'll start with the definition, because I think that's always useful. What is chronic diarrhea? What's the definition, and how long does a patient have to have had it for to actually be defined as chronic?
Yep. So chronic diarrhea is normally defined or agreed by most experts to be loose stools more than 4 weeks. But if you look at the room 4 criteria for irritable bowel syndrome, diarrhea type or functional diarrhea, then they would use more than 6 months. So you're talking about at least 4 weeks, 1 month, then you can define as chronic diarrhea. That's the duration part. But in terms of stool forms and frequency, there's no definition, to be honest. I mean, in the old days, people tend to weigh the stools, but clearly it's not clinically practical. It's extremely hard. So, yeah. If we look, specifically look at the room 4 criteria for the functional bowel disease in the diarrheal group, then they are looking at more than 25% of the stools to be type 6 or 7 based on the Bristol stool chart. Mm-hmm. So as the stool forms, but in terms of frequency, there's really no consensus on how many times patients have to go to qualify that.
Okay. That's really useful. Thank you. So when a patient presents with diarrhea as their presenting complaint, what key things should the clerking doctor be asking for, particularly things like red flags and things that might point you towards a direction of a particular differential?
So obviously the history you take will basically, you're trying to work out what the etiology of the diarrhea is. So you want to know what the duration is, what do they actually mean by diarrhea? What I normally do in clinic, or when I clerk a patient, I will just bring up a Bristol stool chart just to show them what kind of stool forms they are actually talking about. And any other associated symptoms like pain, abdominal pain, any changes in terms of pain in relation to the defecation? Does the pain get better after defecation? Or what's their normal bowel habit like? So just to compare with any weight loss or any associated symptoms which might suggest underlying inflammatory bowel disease like eye problems, joint problems, or recurrent ulcers.
Mm.
And I normally would ask whether there's any history, family history of inflammatory bowel disease or bowel issues, or whether they are on any other medications, like any regular medications or new medications around the onset of the diarrhea. What will be useful as well is to see whether they've had surgeries in the past, because certain operations can point towards certain etiologies of the diarrhea. Obviously, in terms of red flags, you are looking at rectal bleeding, unexplained weight loss, those kind of symptoms, then that will be alarming to whoever's clerking the patient. Then you might want to do some urgent tests like endoscopy to investigate further.
Mm. Yeah, and we'll come on to some more investigations in a minute. So you mentioned an important point there about checking what medications people could be on, because obviously side effect of quite a lot of medications is GI disturbance. Are there anything in particular that would stand out that you would routinely ask in terms of medications?
Yeah, so I would normally check whether they take a lot of lactulose or laxatives. Actually, a lot of patients do. If someone's been labeled as IBS, because we are working in a secondary care setting, a lot of patients already been started on like mebufferine, buscopan, those type of medications, they can actually slow down the gut they modulate the pain, but at the same time, they can cause the bowel to be very sluggish. So actually, some people actually have underlying constipation with overflow diarrhea. So the more common ones are PPIs, and sometimes like sertraline and all those SSRI, sometimes they can cause diarrhea as well. But the time is quite important. So you need to establish when the diarrhea started, how long they've been on the medication for. Also, the other thing is antibiotic use. So any recent antibiotic, then you might worry about C. diff or just antibiotic-induced diarrhea as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so those are the medications you have to consider.
Okay, and that then brings us on to our investigations. So what would be your routine investigations for someone that was presenting with chronic diarrhea, and why are you doing the tests? What would it show?
So in terms of basic blood tests, so obviously I want to know whether there's any thyroid function tests, maybe hypothyroidism, which can cause diarrhea. Quite rare, and to be honest, in clinical practice, you see someone who have an overactive thyroid with diarrhea. It is actually quite rare, but it's one of the tests you can't miss. The other tests you want to know is CELAC serology. So normally do a TTG. And the other blood tests would be looking at user and yeast, see whether there's any electrolyte disturbances. And that's pretty much it in terms of blood tests, I would say. Then going on to stool tests, which pretty much most patients will have had done by the time they present to a secondary care. So normally patients will have got some stool cultures on the system. And depending on the GPs, most of them will have done a fecal calprotectin just to look at whether there's an underlying inflammatory bowel disease, like Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis. Most of them nowadays will have a FIT test, so fecal immunochemical tests. So that's part of screening tests for bowel cancer. And if fecal calprotectin is an or FIT, especially FIT if it's elevated, then normally they will go straight to a two-week wait, directed tests, colonoscopy, and triaged by the colorectal nurse first, then go for colonoscopy, and then come to gastro normally, how it works. In some cases, you might consider to do parasites over cysts, especially in those who are immunosuppressed. That's pretty much it in terms of stool tests. And obviously, if you're worried about antibiotic use, then you want to look for C. diff as well in the stool tests. So those are the basic tests. Then coming to the other tests like CT scans or endoscopic investigations. So it all depends on what the history is like or what the blood tests are like. So if someone who is over 50 with anemia or new anemia with some bowel changes or history involves red flags, alarming symptoms, then you probably would need to go into the bowel and have a look if they are fit enough. If they're not fit enough, then you can either do a CT colonogram or consider doing a CT chest, abdomen, pelvis if their performance status is not great and they are not going to be a candidate for surgery. So that can be discussed with the patient. But obviously, CT chest, abdomen, pelvis is not perfect to look for intraluminal mass, but it might give you an idea of extraluminal problems.
And can you tell us a little bit more about the CT colonography? Because obviously it gets used instead of a colonoscopy for people that aren't that fit, but you still need to have an element of fitness to be able to tolerate the procedure itself.
Yeah, that's correct. So they still need to tolerate the bowel prep quite well. So if someone's wheelchair bound and might struggle to go to the loo, open their bowels in time, then you might have to reconsider whether they're actually fit enough for CT colonogram. You still need to cleanse the bowel with the bowel prep.
Mm-hmm.
And it's slightly less invasive, but they go to radiology, they still have to lie down with a tube into their bottom and pumping gas in. So it's not that pleasant. And a lot of patients don't actually tolerate it very well. So if you have a very elderly patient who are not going to be fit enough for surgery, then you might reconsider whether it's worth doing a CT coronagram in the first place.
And are there any other tests that might get done, any other special tests or anything?
Yeah, so obviously those are the main tests you are considering first, like colonoscopy, CT, and then if you're looking at like further down the line, if you are suspecting someone who might have some sort of bile acid or bile salt malabsorption or diarrhea nowadays, what we call, then you can do a specific test called CCAT scan. And actually, the data suggests one third of the patients with IBS type symptoms have underlying bile acid diarrhea. And they are easily picked up by a CCAT scan and is easily treatable. So actually nowadays we're doing more and more CCAT scans with patients with IBS type symptoms. So that's something we should consider. And it's more prevalent in patients who had previous cholecystectomy and someone who's slightly overweight. So those are the risk factors. Then if you consider someone who might have atrophic pancreas or previous pancreatitis because of gallstone or heavy alcohol use, then you will want to do a fecal elastase just to look for pancreatic exocrine insufficiency. But bear in mind, that test is not very accurate, especially when you have a very loose sample. It tends to give you a falsely low result. So 100 is the cutoff. And if the patient gives a very watery, loose stool sample, then it might be very, very low and it gives you a false positive diagnosis. And again, it's easy treatable. So you can treat a patient with Creon, and patient tends to respond quite well if the medication is optimized. Then the other condition you can consider is a small bowel bacterial overgrowth or small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. So this condition is very hard and quite challenging to treat, very hard to diagnose because there's no perfect tests. There are two ways to diagnose it. One is to go down with a scope and aspirate some jejunal fluid to count the bacterial load. That's the gold standard test in the textbook. But the second way, which is slightly less invasive, is to do a breath test, either using lactulose or glucose, and then to see what the readings are like. Both tests have their pros and cons. And the problem with SIBO is a lot of people or a lot of even specialists don't recognize the condition. And there's no consensus on which antibiotic to use or how long we should treat the patient with antibiotics for. But this condition should really be considered in patients who've undergone major abdominal surgeries, like right-sided hemicolectomy. So there's a slightly higher risk of colonic translocation upstream to the small bowel. So those are the types of patients you might consider treating them with antibiotic, like rifaximin, for a few days or 7 to 10 days to see how they respond. Then the rarer cause you can consider is NET, like gut, or you can do a whole panel of blood tests to look for fasting gut hormone profile. You're worried about those fancy and interesting intraluminal cancer. And in other cases, if the history is very consistent, then you might want to do certain breath tests to look for like lactose intolerance or sucrose intolerance, that type of carbohydrate intolerance. So those are basically the conditions you might want to consider.
So there's quite a wide range of problems there, from
Yes.
Complications of medications to complications of surgery or consequences of surgery to inflammatory bowel disease to problems with different types of food. Like there's lots of different differentials to consider.
Yeah, it is very hard to cover the, such a broad condition, to be honest. But those are the main types, I have to say.
And obviously the management is then tailored to your diagnosis. So is there a general overall management for diarrhea, or is it really quite condition specific?
Yeah, it is quite condition specific. Obviously, most patients will turn out to have irritable bowel syndrome, IBS. And if you look at the guidance, actually, if you look at the NICE guidance, if the patients meet the room criteria without any alarming symptoms or red flags, then we should really make a positive diagnosis of IBS. But that way, you can potentially miss a small group of patients with a treatable condition. So one of the conditions is bile acid malabsorption. And that's why more and more people are doing CCAT. But in terms of treatment, it's really, really guided by what the etiology is. So if you're talking about inflammatory bowel disease, obviously you have a spectrum of medications for Crohn's and colitis. Also microscopic colitis, and it's slightly different, also a subtype of inflammatory bowel disease. So that's also slightly different from the conventional IBD like Crohn's or colitis. So it's really driven by what the etiology is.
Okay, so we won't go into too much more detail about that because it's probably outside the scope of one podcast alone. But thank you so much today for talking us through the initial assessment and investigation of somebody with chronic diarrhea. It's much appreciated.
You're very welcome.
Thanks everyone for joining us on Memcast. We'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.